Okay, this half we'll take questions from the audience, and if we run out of those, we'll finish. We'll go on with these. I ask you two things. One, do not make a long statement or argument. Ask a legitimate question. I mean, it can be a provocative question, certainly. And try to minimize any follow-up questions, because I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of people asking questions. Okay, we'll start. Yeah, back there. All right, good. Yeah.
Okay, did I understand the question? You're just comparing a central bank with competing banks?
But 100% reserve bank. With
pardon?
100% reserve.
100% reserve with
fractional reserve. Right? 100%?
Yeah. My reading of Mises, when he talks about fractional reserve, he almost always says in the same breath, a central bank with fractional reserve. And my emphasis would be on the central bank. And I think that's what Mises' emphasis, too, that fractional reserve gets the economy in trouble if it's administered by a central bank. But in my judgment, fractional reserve won't get the economy in trouble if it's administered competitively. That's the whole key, that the central bank has no constraints on itself about what it can make that reserve requirement, whereas the competitive banks, if they hold too little reserves, if they overexpand, they will do themselves in and won't do the economy in. If the central bank expands, it will end up doing the economy in, and that's the big difference. So I don't consider fractional reserve to be inherently fraudulent, and I think as long as you have competition among banks, it's not even inflationary. It turns out that some people argue that fractional reserve is inherently inflationary, but it's not. If you have the same fraction 1 year after the other, the money supply isn't increased. Any inflationary aspect comes from decreasing the fraction, but competition works against the banks doing that. They provide a check on all the other banks, essentially, from overexpanding. I might even illustrate that right now total reserves in the banking system is about 240% of deposits.
Okay. Right.
So if we went to 100% reserve banking, that would be inflationary, wouldn't it? Because you'd be reducing reserves from 240% down to 100%. It's inflationary, okay? But, of course, what's inflationary is reducing the reserves, whether it's from 240 to 100 or from 10% to 5%.
Thank you. Well, I'll address this latter point first. Well, if we went now from 200% banking, it would not mean that the banks would have to create additional demand deposits for the 140% that they have on top of the demand. Right? They could just keep them, so it wouldn't be any problem at all. Right? Could just impose it. It would imply no change right now, whatever.
You're right.
Right? As I see it, well, I mean, there are lots of. I mean, we should not exaggerate the difference of opinion. There are some differences of opinion, but I mean, on the main, especially on the political evaluation of the thing, most Austrian economists agree. So, what we need is competitive banking. Right? We need to get the state out of this. Murray Rothbard, myself, also Walter De Soto, virtually all proponents of 100% reserve banking believe that the question of banking, of fractional reserve banking, is of secondary importance as compared to the problem of fiat money and of central banking. And so there's a full agreement here across the Austrian spectrum. Of course, the problems that we find in fractional reserve banking become multiplied, reinforced, by the presence of a central bank. And fractional reserve banking, as I believe, and as Walter Soto believes too, becomes possible to any significant extent only because you have the government backing up this kind of banking regime. So then the remaining question is, okay, let's say we have got rid of the central bank, we no longer have an immaterial fiat money. We have introduced a metallic base money or some other competitive production of base money. And we would expect that in this competitive process, gold and silver and other metals would become used as base monies. What then about banking? Would we have to outlaw fractional reserve banking? The question here is then, is fractional reserve banking inherently fraudulent? Is it fraudulent necessarily at all times in all places? Here, well, I agree. It's not inherently fraudulent. It can also be stupid.
Okay.
Basic, the basic, that's my personality. It's very generous, warm-hearted. Right? So the basic problem in fractional reserve banking is that you have multiple property titles on the same underlying physical object. So you always have a contradiction. Now, you might say, well, why shouldn't people be able to set up stupid contracts? Why shouldn't they be able to sell flying elephants? I sell to you a flying elephant. You pay me now. I deliver the elephant tomorrow. Comes tomorrow, I cannot deliver. I say, you said you would deliver the flying elephant. And then I can tell you, but you knew that I wouldn't have a flying elephant. Right? Everybody knows that no such thing exists. Right? Of course you can make a contract. Right? And I would not outlaw the practice of making stupid contracts, but that's what it is. And what I expect in this case is that people would just learn from their errors and that fractional reserve banking would very quickly vanish from the scene, especially except for people who like gambling, going to the casinos, and doing all this other exciting stuff. They would still use fractional reserve banks. That's my
opinion. Okay. Let's see. Other questions? All right, I think I saw you, David.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to know what do you think about the Hayek's proposal of the denationalization of money, and especially I would like to know the opinion of Kurzman and Salerno.
I'll start because I have the mic. The idea is a good one. The direction is a good one. We need to introduce competitive money production. What Austrians, especially of a Rothbardian band, have criticized is the idea that Hayek was too much focalized on the production of paper money. Right, so he did have a too restricted view of this process, competitive process. And it's not necessarily that he was against allowing the use of gold and silver. He just didn't take it into account. And that's a weakness in the analysis. And, of course, what I believe and what others have also believed and have explained in print is that there are good reasons to believe that commodity monies would have a competitive edge in this process, and that rather than believing that private fiat money producers or, let's say, pure material money producers would succeed in such a currency competition, we should believe that metallic monies would be selected.
I have something. I have a microphone.
Yes, it's a microphone.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I have something even understood.
I pretty much agree with Professor Professor Holzman said. I like Hayek's pamphlet on was it currency and competition?
Choice
and currency. I thought that was a great pamphlet. There, what he said was to repeal legal tender laws, get rid of various, I don't know if he went this far, but get rid of taxes on gold and silver, allow banks to, in the U.S., for example, to offer deposits denominated in foreign currencies. I like that part of his proposal. The next pamphlet or booklet, the denationalization of money, my objection to that is simply that he doesn't. It's really an entrepreneurial scheme that he sets up. I just don't see. I'm not persuaded that sort of privately issued fiat monies, if you will gain circulation. I don't think Hulsman's would gain circulation. I certainly don't think Salerno's would gain circulation. You know, being Italian from New Jersey, I just don't. He has not convinced me that. There's a way that people can value these monies before they are in circulation. So it's sort of a catch-22. I would just say that I like the spirit. I mean, for Hayek, to, late in his life, to come out so vigorously, in favor of private money. I just think it's great. I even like the way the booklet is written and a lot of the history in the beginning of the nationalization of money. I just don't like the scheme.
Yeah. Hayek says in several articles that followed that, in interviews and so on, that he first introduced that idea of competition in currency as what he called a bitter joke. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
He said it was a bitter joke. In other words, right. He was so disgusted right. with what the central bank was right. doing right. that he said, well, if that's what they're going to do, let's just go private, have competition. And it was supposed to be a bitter joke, but it sort of caught on. He was surprised, I think, that some people sort of warmed up to that, and then he ended up writing quite a little bit about it and himself taking it more seriously than he did at the beginning. And I'll agree with Joe that I think Choice in Currency is a better pamphlet than Denationalization of Money. Denationalization is too constructivist. And then there was still a later one, I think it was later, he has an essay in Money in Crisis where he talks about how you get people to accept fiat money. And he said, what's key, one thing that's key is the name of the money. Oh. Did you know this? It's the name of the money. And he says he himself has thought of a name that just might do the trick. And he has a footnote. Now, what's the name? You look at the footnote. And he says, on legal advice, he'd been advised not to reveal the name in order to get it.
Why?
That's in Choice in Money in Crisis.
What's Money in Crisis? I don't.
Money in Crisis.
Seen that pamphlet or article.
Yeah, it's an article in that collected volume. I'll give
oh,
you.
Oh, Money in Crisis. Oh, it's that's right. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Have to take a look at that.
So, Hayek was getting a little funny about it at that part.
Okay.
But Choice in Currency. That's the one to read.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. Okay. I think you had your hand up next. Rothbard shirt. You had to look down and check? Okay.
I know some of the people on the panel have been really critical about what you could call the secondary Hayek, the Hayek who wrote Economics, mm-hmm. the Use of Knowledge in Society, and right. Economics and Knowledge. I was wondering, what exactly is your critique, and should we disregard that Hayek entirely, or just right. be really critical okay. at reading?
Okay, I read your question. I've been sort of critical of the Hayek, too, very critical in some respects. First of all, I don't think you should ever dismiss anything that Hayek writes. I think you should read the stuff, Use of Knowledge in Society, Economics and Knowledge. There were three articles. But and I think a lot of the things that he says are important, and both are important and true. What I think his followers have done is to sort of take these ideas and sort of make them, read them back into the socialist calculation debate, and that's what I had focused on. I don't think that socialist calculation is about the dispersion of knowledge or in society. Hayek may have did say that later on that it was in one of his later articles, I think on the problems with market socialism. But so I would disagree with him on that, certainly. And the only things I would really, really disagree with is his later stuff on cultural evolution, which I don't find much value in. But I certainly would read, Hayek's collection, Individualism and Economic Order, and his essays on philosophy, economics. There's two volumes of those. I think all of that is worth reading. But I think this knowledge paradigm that has grown up, formulated by his followers, that really knowledge is the explanation of everything, that prices convey knowledge, that actual prices that we seek somehow convey knowledge that is useful for entrepreneurs for the future. I sort of object to that. I'm opposed to that view. I think prices today are simply just that. They tell you what, they result from past conditions. Now, you can use those prices as an entrepreneur for your understanding of future conditions and to forecast the future prices that are really relevant to your planning. Though I think Rogers has stressed that Hayek has in some place said that prices are not marching orders. How does that phrase go? They're prices are simply guides. They're not marching orders. That was my objection, that prices tell us what to do. The prices that we see today tell us how to, you know, where to allocate resources. Okay, and I think some of his followers maybe lapse into that view, and I think that's wrong. Okay. Okay. Go ahead. I saw you hear me.
So this question is for Dr. Holton. I really want to understand your theory.
Don't ask it. We talked about it at lunch. No, don't get him teasing. I would have avoided.
The reason why your criticism of Mises' theory for why interest exists and profit exists, and then your explanation of it, and then somebody else's criticism of Dr. Holton's.
This is more valuable than what he's going to say at the end. No, I'm only kidding, Guido. Only kidding.
Well, I did not criticize Mises' distinction between interest and profit and loss. I think it's a very important distinction.
Yeah.
Right. So the question concerns only the cause of pure interest. Why is there such a thing as pure interest? That's the question.
Yeah.
So Mises says it's time preference, pure time preference, in the sense that each individual human being, by doing what he does, demonstrates thereby that he wants to have his end achieved earlier rather than later. So my criticism of Mises consists in saying that what he says is true, but it holds true only for individual actions. Whereas the problem in interest theory is to construe a connection between at least two actions. We're buying factors of production now, we are selling later products in certain prices, so we need to explain the relationship that exists between these two actions. You get to this actually if you apply Böhm-Bawerk's theory. That makes much more sense. Then you have a connection between two actions. But the foundation is psychological, it's not praxeological. So we have a difficulty here. My proposition consists in saying, well, let's consider the fact that there always is a relationship, a value relationship, between means and ends. Ends always have a higher value, subjectively, than the means that are necessary to attain the end. And this is then the key to understand the relationships between actions that consist in, well, buying factors of production and actions that consist in selling products on the market. That's all.
Okay.
The point.
Other questions?
Criticism.
Wow. No criticism.
No criticism.
No criticism. Yeah, okay. Yes.
Can someone on the panel discuss the relative differences between Keynesians, neo-Keynesians, new Keynesians, post-Keynesians?
Would you take a crack at that?
You left out some of the Keynesians. Now you left out some of the Keynesians. There's hydraulic Keynesians and colliding Keynesians and splenetic Keynesians. So there are lots of them. But everybody is an adjectival Keynesian. Not too many fundamentalists left. The post-Keynesians, which are pretty much a separate school from Keynes, the post-Keynesians, offer a blend of cost of production theory, which comes from David Ricardo, and Keynesian demand failures. It's sort of an unholy marriage in that, in Ricardo's view, everything is supply determined. That's the classical cost of production theory of value. Everything is supply determined. So who cares whether there's demand failures? It's all determined by supply anyhow. But nevertheless, those are the two sets of ideas that get merged to make post-Keynesianism. All right. The neo-Keynesians, that comes from Samuelson, doesn't it?
Yes, I'm pretty sure.
Isn't that his name?
Neoclassical thinking.
And it's sort of a merging of Keynesian theory with neoclassical theory, supply and demand, microeconomics, and gives rise to the ISLM apparatus, conjoined with some supply and demand labor market, and which gives you an aggregate supply, aggregate demand. That's what's in all the textbooks. That's neo-Keynesianism. New Keynesianism is something different still, and that's associated well with a lot of people. Greg Mankiw is the one I think of, and and there are lots of others. And it focuses on reasons. They call them sophisticated reasons. I think that's in dispute, just how sophisticated they are. A lot of economists like to claim sophistication for themselves, and I'm always suspect. But they say, whereas Keynes simply assumed that prices are sticky, that they have sophisticated reasons for showing why prices are sticky. It has to do with menu costs. It costs to change the prices on the menu. That would be an example of menu costs and so on. And that's New Keynesianism. But those people, Mankiw in particular, freely admit that they could just as well call themselves new monetarists as new Keynesians. You know,
that's true.
There's not that much of a distinction there. And Leland Yeager, who is an old monetarist, I guess, what is he, showed me just recently an article in St. Louis Fed Bulletin that's called The New Monetarism. Yeah, Did you see that?
I printed it out, but I didn't read it yet. Yeah.
Okay, I challenge you to read it. It's incomprehensible. But in The New Monetarism, the claim was that, well, these people are calling themselves New Keynesians. We need something to counter that. We'll call it New Monetarism. And again, it's I think if you read both, you wouldn't figure out which is the New Monetarism and which is the New Keynesianism. But a lot of these schools have the word new in them. It's just, and that's, you know, that's the, it's almost embarrassing, like new and improved. You know, you usually reserve those kind of names for washing powder or something.
Are there any new Austrians?
No, there are no new Austrians. I said in one of my lectures earlier that there's even a difference between post-Keynesians with a hyphen and post-Keynesians without the hyphen. And I've been calling myself an unhyphenated Austrian, so
that's good.
I just, you know, there are lots of different names.
Okay. Questions? Max?
So Professor Gordon mentioned behavioral economics during his lecture today. Are there any non-Austrian developments in econ that you guys are following and that you guys think are particularly interesting? Any non-Austrian economic that you suggest reading
today? No. I think there are.
No, I mean there are very, of course. I mean, one thing that we should never forget that the people who are teaching at the universities, very often, especially at the good universities, are very intelligent people. And so they are hampered by the fact that they don't have an Austrian starting point, but they're still pretty good people. Now, as far as their theoretical work is concerned, I find this almost without any value whatever, without whatever the school. But as far as the empirical work is concerned, there's lots of that is interesting, inspiring, thought-provoking, and so on. And I read this with great profit, especially my field, which is money banking, financial markets. This is very good work out. For example, Carmen Reinhardt and what's the other guy, co-author? This Time is Different. This is a very interesting book.
That's a good book.
Yeah, it's a very good book. So, I mean, Austrians can read this with great profit, and we should do.
Ben Powell has suggested that Austrians shouldn't be quite as hostile to experimental economics as we sometimes are. The problem is if experimental economics is taken as somehow attempting to establish or disestablish, you know, praxeological claims by experiment, then it's going to be misguided. But a lot of applied economics or economic history or whatever you want to call it, the stuff that Mises calls themology, the stuff that helps us understand how the actual concrete application of praxeological principles in terms of people's sexual preferences and so forth. Powell is making the point that experimental economics could be useful for those purposes, and that he found some of its work useful. So I haven't read any experimental economics. So I'm just channeling Ben.
There's also an interesting guy at UCLA, Leo Hanian, who's written a couple of articles, one of which appeared in a leading mainstream journal, Journal of Economic Theory, in which he challenges the Friedmanite assumption that the Depression, Great Depression, was prolonged by monetary policy, by the Fed bumbling and inadvertently deflating the money supply, or allowing the money supply to contract. And in fact, his explanation involves citations and quotations of Rothbard. That is, that there was a labor market failure. So he couches it in neoclassical terms, but basically uses the argument that Rothbard uses in America's Great Depression to explain the length of the Great Depression. Okay, back there.
Oh, I was wondering if you could explain the either economic or philosophical differences that Ayn Rand has with Mises and the Institute, or the general Austrian school of economics.
Okay, I guess that's probably for me.
Yeah.
Well, Ayn Rand herself didn't have any disagreements with the Mises Institute, because I think she died right around the time it was founded, 82-ish. Rand's relationship to Austrian economics was complicated. She liked Mises' economic work. She didn't like his philosophical framework, which she took it to be his philosophical framework. But she was a big promoter of Mises. She used to recommend people read his books. She had his books positively reviewed, most of them in her newsletter. She didn't like Hayek at all. She says he was poison, and she didn't like, you know, she had a brief association with Rothbard, but that ended badly, and she didn't like him either. In Hayek's cases, because he was too statist. In Rothbard's cases, because he wasn't statist enough. So Mises was just right, like the third bowl of oatmeal. With the theoretical apparatus of praxeology, I think, which she took issue with, I think to some extent she exaggerated the differences between her position and his. Now, he described his a priori theory in terms of a Kantian framework, and she was very much opposed to that. But I think that a lot of Mises' praxeological ideas Rothbard took, you know, probably under Rand's influence to some extent, and recast in an Aristotelian framework. And I can't see why she would need to have any objection to those praxeological principles in the way that Rothbard had reformulated them in an Aristotelian way. But the notion of if by a priori you mean literally, because sort of completely independent of all experience, she didn't think that there was any knowledge that was independent of all experience. But Rothbard thought that praxeological principles were based on experience in a very broad sense, of just sort of the basic experience of being a human being, and not on sort of empirical testing of particular theses. Also, she didn't like the fact that Mises rejected natural right. So that's, again, a reason she should have liked Rothbard better, but maybe Rothbard liked natural rights too much.
Roderick, she blasted Friedman and Stigler when they wrote about rent control.
Oh, yeah. Roger just saying that when Friedman and Stigler came up with the famous Roofs or Ceilings article on rent control, you can read in her letter she wrote to Leonard Reed, saying, why did you allow these two pinkos to or maybe she didn't say pinkos. Maybe she said reds. I forget exactly
really?
The precise shade. but basically, her objection, at least part of her objection, was that their argument was purely utilitarian. So suggesting that, you know, it would be perfectly fine to have these price controls if they had, you know, beneficial results for society. But in fact, it looks like the best strategy is something else. And she took them to mean that, in effect, the government had the perfect right to completely control everyone's property, but simply that it wasn't pragmatic to do it. So really, it was an objection to the fact that it was purely utilitarian as opposed to a rights-based argument. Although when Mises did similar things, she didn't mind it as much. But then, you know, even though Mises is utilitarian, there's a sense, there's a certain kind of, you know, rightsy rhetoric to him that that you don't get as much in, you know, some more traditionally utilitarian economists.
Is it fair to say that? Do I get to ask a question?
Sure.
Is it fair to say that when an economist made an economic argument, Rand objected because he didn't make a philosophical argument?
Well, maybe that's the right thing to say about the Friedman and Stigler piece, but she, you know, she recommended, you know, Mises' work, and she said she disagreed with the philosophical framework, but she liked his economic reasoning. So she didn't seem to be against, you know, economic reasoning as such. You know, she didn't seem to think it was wrong just to have a book that's full of economic arguments and doesn't have natural rights. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure to what exactly why she preferred Mises to Friedman. To what extent it was a matter of sort of actually seeing some difference in their economic analysis. I think there are aspects of Rand's thought that are sort of, especially, there's a certain affinity with Austrian thought, and the whole thing, her whole ethics is kind of based on the structure of means and ends, and what means you're committed to in virtue of adopting certain ends, and the value of things getting the means getting their value from the end, and so on. So I think there's a kind of philosophical affinity between Austrian economics and Rand that maybe she didn't see with Friedman.
Green tree.
This is for Herbner Long, and this might be a really easy question, but I just can't wrap my head around it. When the tech bubble, the Fed increased money supply, how did that money specifically flow into the stock market? And when Mises talked about the master builder and running out of resources, what specific resources, were run out of to make internet companies? For some reason, that's just, I can't bring that down to it. You know what I mean? I mean, in the master builder, you run out of resources, and the stock bubble burst. What resources were specifically, depleted? Or
I think long must be a mispronunciation of Garrison there, but let me give it to Jeff first.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You'd have to do the empirical work to find out. I mean, it isn't obvious that the the area where the resources have been invested in longer projects that aren't completed during the boom.
Oh, sorry.
Is the area where the collapse comes, or where the press focuses upon, the sort of prominent area of the collapse. So if the tech industry collapses, you had a bunch of dot-com businesses that start up in Silicon Valley or whatever. And they're the ones where you see the liquidation process afterwards. So now we know where the malinvestment was, and we can see the liquidation. And, we'd have to do the empirical work to try to ascertain where the areas of the economy were. There were projects that were undertaken that weren't completed. I mean, sometimes we don't focus on this, right, because we're just interested in seeing.
No, it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It is.
The story with Mises about the master builder, the story, the master builder runs out of bricks. He starts to build a building that's larger than what the bricks will permit, runs out of bricks. That's a parable. It's a parable, and it is in a setting totally divorced from a market economy. It's just a pile of bricks. And he runs out because there weren't enough bricks in the pile to finish the project. In a market setting, instead of literally running out of resources, you just begin facing higher input prices before you finish. So what would be running out is instead comes in the form of more expensive resources. And when that happens, then at least some of the people pursuing projects will realize that to press on would be to finish it at such a loss that they'd be better off stopping now, okay? So it's the price system at work in the market system that shuts some of those projects down and results in the downturn.
So if you have to do a program, it might be something like website.
Let me just add to that. Okay. I read during that period that there was enough fiber optics cable produced to go, here to the moon and back a number of times, and that there would be no way that there was going to be that was going to be absorbed by the demand for it. So, as Roger pointed out, the resources that were complementary to the cable were just not available in quantities and at prices that were sufficient to generate a profitable demand for all those things. So that was sort of the real side of it. Wait, is this your second question?
No.
Okay. You had that was the other guy with the rock portrait. Yeah.
What would you say the interest rate, what role does it play? Like, does it coordinate current consumption with future consumption? Or what would you say if someone says, why is it important? Like, what does it do?
Well, the interest rate coordinates the use of capital across the economy. And it's because in all investment projects, you've got to earn at least that interest, the same return on investment, that you don't overuse capital in some, that is, you're wasting capital, whereas you could finance other projects that cannot be realized because the capital is not available. That's the main function of capital, of the interest rate. Right.
So you would throw out the coordinates current consumption with future consumption thing only because you're saying that's not what's really leading to pure interest.
Yeah, well, I do not believe this, yeah, indeed. Yeah. But, okay, that's wonderful. But, right. But of course, there is this coordination between present consumption and future consumption is a consequence that results from the market process that equalizes the return on investment in all investment projects. That is a more or less unintended consequence of this process, right? So it's not something that can be really separated from the interest rate. It is something that is implied. But of course, we cannot, for example, one thing that I do not believe anymore is that a reduction of the interest rate represents a lower time preference and therefore entails longer production periods, whereas a higher time preference entails shorter production periods, so makes present consumption more important as compared to later consumption. Right? All these things are a little bit in a flux in my mind right now. No, not fundamentally, not the Austrian business cycle. It changes somewhat the Austrian theory of capital, but not the theme of the Austrian business cycle theory, which is a theory of error clusters and of malinvestment.
Yeah, you had your hand up for a while.
What are the panel's thoughts on intellectual property rights?
I'm against them. I suspect probably most of us up here are, but I think most of us are, except something broadly like Stefan Kinsella's argument that because intellectual items aren't scarce in the way that ordinary physical items are, in the sense that I can copy something of yours, and you've still got it. So there's no need for us to conflict over it. That therefore we shouldn't analogize these as being like ordinary property rights, but they're more like protectionism or even censorship. And that if you restrict people's ability to use their own minds and their own property to copy or imitate something that they see that you've done, then in effect you're violating their property rights, their rights to their own. Their own body and their own paper. Like, if you memorize everything I'm saying up here right now, so you're storing a copy of it in your brain, and then you then transcribe that onto paper that you own with ink that you own and so forth. And then you exchange that for something that someone else owns. Then if I interfere with that, then I'm claiming a right to control you. So I think that on both sort of economic utilitarian grounds. It doesn't have the scarcity kind of reason for having intellectual property, and on moral grounds, you don't have the same justification of it you have it for private property. But any dissenters? No. We don't allow dissent on this panel.
Okay, one more question here. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. If one of my friends is going to start a bakery and I buy a stove for him and I recognize this is my stove, I'm lending it to you. And then he takes the bakery and takes the stove and he drops it on somebody's head or something. Should I be held liable for the damage that he's done? And this is for Mr. Long. And this is an analogy for a corporation.
All right, so there's a question about should you be liable for basically the question is, should you, to what extent are you liable for the use that your agent makes of your property? And I've been, I'm not an expert in law, but I'm inclined to say that it seems to me like it's a matter of degree. It depends on the extent to which they're acting sort of very directly as your agent versus something more, more remote. If I hire a bodyguard, I tell the bodyguard, protect me against anyone you perceive as a threat to me, and they just go around, beating up everyone, and, I just smile and nod and so forth, then it seems like I've got some liability. On the other hand, if it's something more remote, and the extent of my responsibility seems weaker, it seems like there's less of a case for holding me liable for what my so-called agent does. But I don't have any argument of, where to draw the line or what kinds of remedies you should have. So if we're dealing with the case of the case of corporations, where the question is, is there a justification for limited liability? Are investors liable for things that in limited liability in tort cases where the corporation does something, causes an oil spill. I just made that example up, but to what extent are the investors should the investors be? Is it right to hold them exempt? And I think it might be. I mean, although I'm supposed to be the lefty up here, I'm not sure that things like, I think there may be a case for perhaps not the precise kind of limited liability we have now, but a case for limited liability just reflecting the actual lesser degree of responsibility that the investors have. But then I'm inclined to say, well, someone's got to be responsible. Some human beings have got to be responsible, not just an abstract entity like the corporation. So if the investors aren't held responsible, then the managers would have to be. But I don't claim expertise on this issue. Anyone else have thoughts on this?
Well, if they do, we don't have any more time. Okay. Thanks for the great questions.